You're listening to the Vegans Explore Network, found at vegansexplore.com.
We have a tradition, and what we do is we ask our guests to tell us how they got started on their vegan journey. I don't think I got around to asking that the last time that we spoke with each other. So in honor of that tradition, we would love to know, how did you first get started? You know, what seeds were planted for you to go down this path?
Well, you know, I was a very slow learner. And so I have a lot of understanding for people who don't get it initially. It took me a while. I grew up with a father who was a gourmand, and together we basically ate our way through the animal kingdom. And I have to tell you that when I was about 19 or 20, liver and onions, I would go anywhere for it. And I would use raw steak and put a raw egg in it and mix it up and eat it. So I am not somebody who grew up as a vegan or a vegetarian or anything near that. But a series of events changed me. And it was one at a time. The very first thing was snails. I used to eat snails. And I'm a bad cook. But I bought some live snails in a market, this Italian market. They said, oh, they're easy. You can just take them home, you soak them overnight, and then you saute them in some chablis and garlic. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I had them in a paper bag in my car. I was driving through the countryside to my house, and I got the feeling I was being watched. And I thought, there's no one here. I looked over, and the snails had forced open, and they do this. In my book, I talk about this in another way. But they came to the top of the bag and had pushed open the top, and they were all up there looking at me with their little horn, you know, looking. So I took them and let them go in the bottom of my garden.
Oh, that's nice.
I probably violated some federal law, but I wasn't going to eat them. So that was the end of snails. Next came lobsters. Somebody took me for this gorgeous dinner for my birthday. I think I was 19. In Philadelphia, a lobster restaurant. And they brought two lobsters to the table. On a silver platter, alive, and you had to pick your lobster. And I did. And the lobsters were waving their antennae at you. And I said, I'll have that one. And they said, broiled or boiled? And back then, I was so oblivious. I had no idea that if you say broiled in a restaurant like that, they slit open the live lobster's back, put it, butter all through it, salt and pepper, and shove it under the grill. And so I said, broiled. That lobster came back. We were having a great time. We had some beautiful wine. And it was a lovely event. I took that first bite of lobster. And something must have triggered. Something must have hit me subconsciously. I burst into tears. Because I realized the only method of communication those lobsters had was to waggle their antennae. They didn't speak English. They don't have voices like anybody else. And I had taken his life for my birthday. So that was the end of all shellfish, all mollusks. That is gone. And the next thing, I'll just leave you with the one, because this is the slow learner story. I was a law enforcement officer in Maryland. And I went to a farm where the people had moved away and they had left the animals behind. And the animals had starved. They had had a party and they had had broken glass in the stalls and the animals were cut up, but they were all dead except for one little pig. And I took that little pig outside and I put his head under the water pump and held up his head so he could drink. And he made these little sounds of gratitude, that's all you can say. And then I sent him off to the veterinarian. I was going to prosecute those people for failure to pay rent, for abandonment, and so on. Driving home that night, and this was before we had microwave ovens, I thought, oh, I'm starving. What have I got to eat? And I thought, oh, great. I defrosted the pork chops.
No.
And then, you know, ding, ding, ding. I thought, hang on a minute. I'm going to prosecute those people for what they did to that little pig. And yet I know in my heart, and now I know with my eyes from later, I know in my heart, as we all do, that a slaughterhouse is a hideous place. And the pork chops came from a slaughterhouse, from a pig who couldn't have wanted to die. So that really was the beginning of that. And later, somebody razzed me terribly and said, what are you putting in your tea? And every morning I had a cup of tea with condensed milk in it.
Mm.
And I said, it's condensed milk. And he said, well, you don't eat veal, do you? And I said, no, of course not. I would never take a baby cow away from his mother for veal. And he said to me, so how do you think you get the milk? Don't you have to take away the baby cow? Isn't there a bit of veal in every glass or drop of milk? And I said, but they don't kill the cow, do they? They don't kill the cow. You know, you hear that.
Mm-mm.
And I said it. Oh, how mortifying. And today, if someone says that to me, I always say, oh, really? Where is this massive retirement home for cows? Because I've never seen one. You know, they all get kicked and prodded down the ramp to their deaths, the same as the beef cow does, except those mother cows are in worse condition. So that was the end of the milk.
Wow. So it seems like every step of the way, there is this connection to an actual living being that made you, you know, quit that particular type of eating that type of animal. So my question to you is, with everything that you just said, take us into the creation of PETA, because that's a story that I don't often hear. So how did you go from having all of these revelations to saying, I want to, you know, be one of the co-founders of actually, you know, I'm sure you could have forecasted of where it would have gone when you first started, but let's just say I'm going to start something that, you know, is going to be for the protection of these animals. So take us through that.
It was definitely because of these experiences and more. I thought, you know, I grew up loving animals. I really would say that because I adored the dog who was in my house when I was born and who I grew up with. His name was Shawnee. We did everything together. He was like my brother. You know, I could feel what he was feeling. He could feel what I was feeling. I slept in his bed. He slept in my bed. We both went in the car and got car sick at the same time. We would always just be ready at the same time. My mother would stop the car. But I didn't realize how animals are treated. I'd never been to a factory farm. I'd never seen inside a laboratory until much later. And that was another experience I had that woke me up. I'd never done any of these things that took you behind the scenes to where animals are caught in steel traps to make a fur coat or something. But as my experiences grew, and I did actually find when I was a law enforcement officer, two steel traps set behind a 7-Eleven. Mm. And these young kids had bought them. They're just, you know, $3 a piece. Excuse me. And I set them out there and they'd caught a fox and they caught a squirrel. And I'd always had a fur coat since I was 19. So that was another revelation. And I thought, if I love animals and I've had all these revelations, there must be lots of people like me who just don't know. So I should start a group and make sure they can see what they're supporting and give them the alternatives. And so PETA was started with that in mind.
And how did PETA look? This was the early 80s. Like, what was the time frame?
It was 1980, actually, exactly 1980. So we're 40 this year. And I'm 70. Look at those wrinkles.
Well, congratulations on the milestone of reaching 40 years for PETA. And how did it look back then? Because obviously we didn't have the technology, the way to communicate right now. So how did you get the word out and how did you slowly begin to build it?
That's an excellent question, because people who are 20 today would just laugh themselves silly as to what we had to do. Of course, there was no internet. Mm-hmm. There were no answering machines. There were no fax machines. There were no mobile phones. There was nothing like that. So you had to basically hand draw things, type things, cut and paste things, make your own leaflets, have them printed at a printer, and go out somewhere where people were gathering and hand them out individually. And then, much as today, you had to try hard to get into the press. And it was mostly newspapers then, or radio shows. There were some talk shows initially. And people were more inclined to give you time to discuss the issue. Today, things are a soundbite. They're like this and they're gone. But it really was, if you wanted to telephone someone, they had to be home or you couldn't reach them. So it was painstaking. And we came out with our first newsletter. We put it in the mail and we sent it out. And we just talked to each other, had work parties. That was it.
And right now, there's been, especially last year, and I'm sure you felt it was a huge year for veganism, just as far as the awareness that was getting out there, especially in the mainstream press and what have you. But what are some of the milestones that you would point to for PETA over the years that you were, I know we watched a few earlier, but like some of the big milestones that you would want to showcase?
Well, the little video earlier was just the last 3 months.
Wow.
So that tells you every day we win something. We're coming out with this week's victories on Monday. And I think some of them will knock your socks off. Of course, at the moment, we are very, very caught up in trying to get animals into the stories about the pandemic. But for me, I think the biggest one is not very sexy, but it's the fact that we were able to put together the biggest youth movement of any social movement that ever has existed. And because the kids have got to come in, the college students, the young people, the children, I mean, they are the Greta Thunbergs. There are lots of them, the Greta Thunbergs of the animal rights movement. You may not know them by name, although some of you know Genesis and people like that, who are just fabulous. So building that was so important. And we have PETA 2, and we have PETA Kids, and we now have the SOS, which is Stop Our Supremacism, Stop Our Speciesism youth campaign. It's all youth driven. If you ask me about concrete cases, I would say in 1981, we got the first conviction ever in the United States of an animal experimenter for cruelty to animals, and the first search warrant that allowed animals to be taken out of the lab. 17 rhesus monkeys who had their backs operated on and their arms rendered immobile and who were kept in terrible conditions. We got them all out and we got the experimenter convicted. A little while later, we stopped head injury experiments at the University of Pennsylvania, conducted to test crash helmets on baboons. And then we stopped all the car companies in the world from using animals like pigs and baboons in car crash tests, which is why you see the mannequins. We talked about this before, I think, on your show, is why we see the mannequins, the crash test dummies, in the commercials now, is because PETA stopped those hideous animal tests that all the car companies except Mercedes did all over the world.
Wow. So behind the scenes of a lot of the things that we've seen, as PETA was like, so what exactly is that you do behind the scenes when you're putting out these calls? Like, can you take us a little bit into that process of what PETA is actually doing behind the scenes?
Yes, we have different departments that do different things. But if we find, for example, a company, whether it's a household product company or it's a car company, whatever it is, if we find that they're doing something cruel to animals, then we first write a letter to them. We go to the top and we write a letter and say, we've discovered you're doing this. Here are the alternatives, which our research department looks into very carefully. We have 19 scientists on staff. We have a coronavirus researcher on staff, oncologists, you name it. So nanotechnologists. So we know, we do our homework. We come out with the alternative to the cruel thing. We write the letter. We phone them up and we try to meet. In the old days, that door was slammed in our face over and over again. Nowadays, many companies are a little bit too nervous. They know it's Peter. Peter could do something. Mm-hmm. So they often will meet with us. And when they meet with our scientists, we'll show them a better way. And we'll show them the economic advantages, the public relations advantages, and the ethical advantages. But a lot of companies say no. The Iditarod, that hideously cruel dog race in Alaska, we've met with them, but they ain't budging right now. And so you saw in the video, we just got Alaska Airlines to withdraw its sponsorship. We've had Chrysler withdraw its sponsorship, an investment company withdraw its sponsorship. And we go to all the sports shows. And we say, don't you dare show the Iditarod, because 150 dogs have died in that race. And that's something they won't tell you, but we will. And here is all the information. And here's our undercover investigation. And we'll win. It's just they're going to fight us and we're going to fight back. But good is on our side and tenacity is our middle name. And we're going to win.
And I want to get back, and there's so many questions I have in regards to PETA and just as an organization, that's what drives me, you know, to see the inner workings. But people listening right now, let's go into the book, the Animal Kind book, and talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this book at this time. Let's start with that, and then we'll go a little bit into what's inside of the book.
Well, you know, I always do the subtitle, because that pretty much sums it up. Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals, that's part one, and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion is the second half. I wrote it because I'm fascinated with everything animals do. Their emotional lives, their communication abilities, their parenting skills, their intelligence, the fact they have to pay so much attention to human beings because human beings control every facet of their lives. You know, they either hide in the woods because we've put a road and a shopping mall there, or they wait at the door to see if you'll let them out to do their business. They have to pay attention. And I thought, there are lots of people who might read a story here, or they might pick up something from their cat at home. There are so many things that are jaw-dropping about animals. I'm going to write a book. It's for our 40th anniversary. I'm going to write a book that makes people go, wow, I didn't know that. And then because they know who animals are and how incredible they are, the second part would be, and here's what you can do about it.
And it's interesting how that sort of mirrors your experience, what you were telling us earlier about how from the snails to the lobster, like making that connection. And this book sort of does that in a way where you get to learn more about the personal characteristics and traits of these animals, and then the what to do about it. So, you want to read the book to hear all the stories, but are there any stories or any examples, at least one example you can share with us?
Well, there are hundreds in the book, so I'm not in any danger of giving all the secrets away. And I do hope people will enjoy it. It's written in a very positive way. There are so many. I didn't realize that dogs, for example, I knew they had enormous sensory capabilities, and I knew that they can actually smell biochemical changes in your body so that they can know if you're about to have an epileptic seizure or if you have a cancer somewhere. I didn't know that they were being used by law enforcement officers nowadays to sniff out thumb drives that might be hidden in a metal box and put in a steel cabinet by child pornographers. I knew that they can, the average dog in your home knows 300 words without ever being taught one. And that's pretty good when you think we don't know even one of theirs. So I learned a lot about dogs and their sense of smell. When you take them outside, you mustn't hurry them. Those bushes that they're smelling, it's their internet. You know, that's how they pick up the news of who went by, whether they were sick, whether they were well, what was going on with them, and all sorts of things about dogs. But I learned things about elephants I didn't know. They, too, have an incredible sense of smell. That trunk is so versatile, too. They can pick up a paperclip with that trunk. They can entwine it around another elephant they haven't seen for years and they've missed and they love. They can get their baby out of a hole with that trunk. And they can use it when they swim. And most elephants, of course, are, if they're in the circus or a zoo, they never get to swim. But elephants are natural swimmers. And in places like Sri Lanka, if they are loose along the side of the water, they will jump in joyously and they could swim for 30 miles and they'll stick that trunk above the water like this as a snorkel as they go along. And of course, they communicate subsonically a mile or two away from one herd to another. And it's not just that the other elephants so far away know, oh, somebody's rumbling over there. They know what it is. It's language. So if there's a drought, they know that those elephants are saying, we found water. Or if someone's capturing the babies, which they do to send to China to a wildlife park, those elephants who are rumbling through the earth to the other elephants are saying, stay away. They're taking our children. So there are so many things. It's just huge.
So you said there's hundreds of stories in the book. You went over a few of them, the elephants, the dogs. So what's the story or what's something that took you by surprise that you were shocked when you realized the information?
I am not surprised that animals are so clever, but I will tell you a couple of things because, you know, pigeons are much derided. People call them, oh, rats with wings. And I like to call rats birds without wings or birds with tails. The pest species are so put down when they're just trying to eke out an existence. But a male pigeon and a female pigeon, both of them make milk in their crop for their baby. And if you see two pigeons together and one pigeon has their beak down the other pigeon's, they could be kissing because they're very sensuous. They marry their high school sweetheart and they're with them at the end of their life. So they could be kissing, but they also could be one or the other of the parents feeding their baby. And they are so loyal. They take turns taking care of the kids. And they really do. They equal out the time. All birds are like that. There's a story about two storks in Croatia. And they fly from this little village in Croatia down to South Africa every year, thousands of miles. Every winter they go down there. Every summer they come back. Except this pair, only the male goes because the female was shot by a hunter, and she can't fly. She was rescued by a teacher. He helped make a beautiful nest for her on the roof of his house. He winters her over inside his house every winter, and every spring, she goes back on the nest, And the whole village comes out on the exact day that the male is due back from South Africa, and they're all waiting for him, and so is she. And he comes back into the nest, and they raise a new brood of chicks every year. One year, he was 6 days late, and everybody was extremely worried. Who knows what ordeals he'd had to go through, but 6 days later, he turned up, and there they are together, in love, in the nest.
So you talked a little bit about stories, and thank you for sharing that story for me. I knew I can get one more out.
I'll do 5,000.
You talked about a few of the stories that are in the book, but you also talked about there's some like what's next, you know, what to do. So can you talk a little bit more about that and what that looks like?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing is it's very nice that people are not using plastic straws these days, because they've seen pictures of turtles with a plastic straw stuck up their nose, and they've seen all this plastic problem. And now, but the thing is this, in the book, I, for example, in part one, I talk about a little fish called the wrasse. It's a tiny little fish. And this little fish is also known as the teeth cleaning fish. And that's because, and you can see this if you go to National Geographic videos or something, big fish line up in the ocean just the way you would at your dental hygienist's office. Mm-hmm. And the little wrasse comes and they open their mouths, and the wrasse goes in and cleans out the debris between their teeth. Tiny little fish from New Zealand. That little fish can recognize herself in a mirror. And that is considered the gold standard of animal intelligence. Mm-hmm. Chimpanzees do it. Tribal peoples don't always do it. They think they're being attacked when they see themselves in the mirror, and they go after that mirror. So it is an intelligence test that humans have passed, chimpanzees, elephants have passed. The little fish sees her reflection in the mirror, and she starts preening, just like Kim Kardashian. She starts, you know, working. Thank God she doesn't have a camera and can't take selfies. But I say, these little intelligences out there, if you want to save the ocean and you want to save sea life in the ocean, it's not just plastic straws. The number one thing is don't eat fish, because the discarded fishing net from the trawlers, the fishing hooks and the line, the plastic filament, all that stuff is the number one destroyer of turtles, dolphins, all ocean life. So if you want to save the oceans, please remember there's a person inside that little finned being or that large shelled being. There's somebody in there. It's not something. And don't eat them.
Mm. And one of the things that in relation to everything and some solutions and some progress that I'm seeing, especially in the news the last couple of months, is the fashion industry. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. Some of the progress that we've been seeing, maybe some innovations that you might have noticed. Like, what can you tell us about what's happening right now in that industry?
It is so exciting. It's just so incredibly exciting. I do talk in the book about cows, for example, because of leather. Of course, the number one thing is leather, and most leather comes from India. And the ordeal of the cows in India is extraordinary. It's heartbreaking. But cows communicate using subtle facial language. If they solve a problem, they have a little eureka moment where they jump up with excitement. They will even hide a calf in some cases if they can, if their experience tells them that the farmer will take the calf away. So they're extraordinary. All animals, of course, are. We've done these undercover videos inside crocodile farms in Zimbabwe, alligator farms in Florida, in Texas, where they're raised in abject filth and they're killed in abysmally cruel ways. So we need to get away from all that. Being vegan doesn't just mean not putting animals in your mouth. It means not putting animals on your back or on your feet and all that stuff. Today, we have the luxury of having pineapple leather, grape leather, apple leather. Somebody was telling me about a mulberry leather just the other day. We have all natural fibers that we can use. We've always had cotton and corduroy and satin and so on. But now we have tassel, we have metallic threads that are used. We have lightweight synthetics that don't get damp and weigh you down if you're climbing Everest or wherever you're going in them for a hike. We have fabulous fabrics, and they're all, even the ones that are synthetic, are better for the environment. There have been studies now that show, you know, you throw a leather coat outside your window, come back 20 years later, it's still there because it's not natural. It was treated with harsh chemicals called mordants to stop it from decomposing. So all the things that go into even synthetic have less energy used, are less environmentally problematic than fur and leather and exotic skins. But you don't have to have anything like that. You can use natural things, jute, hemp, who knows what, cotton and so on. And you can use these new wonderful fruit leathers, which are coming out now for skirts and belts and everything imaginable. And I love Tom's shoes are my favorite in the world.
So, wow. Okay. So we talked about fashion. We talked about, let's talk a little bit about food and what's going on in that space. Because obviously everything that's being created, like with Impossible and Beyond and a lot of the clean meats as well, it's lessening the amount of the need to slaughter animals for the food that people eat. But what are your thoughts on those innovations as a whole?
Well, they're phenomenal. I mean, 40 years ago when Peter started, we never would have imagined. We had such an uphill climb, and you could go to the store and there was really nothing unless you knew how to cook vegetables and you ate fruits and you could buy nuts and grains. But there was nothing that was a taster-like. You could go to a co-op and get a powder that was soy and then mix it with water and whisk it up and try to make a soy milk. There was no, what we have today is almond cheese, rice cheese, you know, soy cheese, all these things, Miyoko's cheeses. There were no fake hot dogs or burgers. So Beyond is a dream come true because Beyond is really a meat eater's vegan burger. And I really challenge anybody to serve a meat eater one and not tell them and have them guess that it wasn't meat. They can't do it. But we have people now, wonderful, innovative companies that are coming up with fake fish and caviar that's the same as caviar. And I've tasted it. I told you my father and I ate our way through the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. We ate caviar. So caviar tastes almost identical to it. There's sometimes a little bit of a taste difference. You have everything you could ever want. There's a restaurant that's serving fake eel, and there is even something like fake blowfish. You think, who wants that? But really, if you want it, you can have it. There's a Japanese restaurant near our headquarters in Norfolk that serves a sushi with fake lobster or fake crab. They have fake salmon steaks. So people say, well, why do you want fake? Well, I want fake because I grew up with those tastes and I'm used to them and I like them. My taste buds think they're okay, but I certainly don't want to give a plug nickel to anybody to slit an animal's throat, hang them up on a hook, put them in the transport truck, have them afraid, clip their ears, cut off their beaks, and all the other ghastly things that are done that don't make us a civilized species at all.
Mm-hmm. And in your journeys, have you come across any fake liver?
You know, that's an excellent question. I haven't gone looking for it, but I'll tell you this. I grew up, a large part of my childhood was in England, and there is a favorite, what they call a working man's pie. It comes in a tin, has a beautiful flaky pastry crust, and it was steak and kidney. And I liked kidneys too. And every night when I got home from work, I would stop at the corner store and get, it's called a Fray Bentos steak and kidney pie, and I would put it in the oven. Our Peter UK has met with Fray Bentos, and they have just come out with a new vegan pie. And when we met, they said, well, we can do fake steak, but we can't do fake kidney. And Dawn, who works for us, said, you can do kidney bean, can't you? So this is the Fray Bentos steak and kidney bean pie that has just come on the UK market. And you know, they're serving a fake chicken at KFC in the UK. I just had that when I was over there before the pandemic hit. Great stuff.
And just speaking of the UK for a little bit, I mean, part of what I do is I follow the news daily, and there always seems to be things coming out in the UK. And I just make up that it's like a test market to see eventually what they want to do in the US. But what are your thoughts on in terms of the growth of these restaurants adopting these alternatives in the United States? What do you see as the potential, and how long before we start seeing, you know, the same, you know, turnaround that Australia and Germany and the UK have in the US?
Oh, it's coming. It's coming. I think you're right that the UK, it's a little island. So it is like an ideal test market. And you can see if it flies there, and then you can spread it out. And of course, KFC in Atlanta test marketed the vegan chicken, and it sold out in 5 hours. And they have a couple of other states that are test marketing it now. And, you know, you can go to Chipotle and get sofritas, which is that fake pork, which is, I think it's phenomenal. But everywhere you go now, you're getting pizza chains are converting to vegan cheese. I mean, it's not the healthiest thing to have any cheese, vegan or not, but it's there. It's everywhere. Uno's, I think we just saw in the video, has just agreed to have, you know, fake meats and vegan cheese. So I am feeling extremely optimistic with the pandemic. You know, people went to the store and they started to hoard, and they knew just instantly you cannot hoard dairy milk. It goes bad. Or dairy. So they got plant milk, and it might have been the first time in their lives. They've got shelves and shelves full of almond milk, macadamia milk, rice milk, soy milk, chocolate flavored, you name it. So all this is happening, and doctors are more and more saying, if you're worried about diabetes or heart disease or cancers, you need to go vegan. You need to get the meat and the dairy. Most important, get the dairy out of your diet. And there's no excuse nowadays. You just wander into any supermarket, even in a small town in the middle of nowhere, and you will find in the freezer case, in the refrigerator case, on the shelves, a wealth, a plethora of ingredients and ready-made meals. You just can't go wrong.
What are some of the topics in the book that you'd want to go over to let people know that are inside of it specifically?
Well, I mean, the easy ones are everybody eats, everybody dresses, although some people, are you in your pajama bottoms there? Let's see. Everybody wears clothes and shoes. Everybody washes their hair, even if they can't get it cut or colored now. So you have all these things that you do, and every day you buy stuff. It's how we entertain ourselves. It's the way we deal with pests. You know, my heart goes out to them because they're just little individuals like ourselves who are given a bad rap. And we have to tell other people, don't use poisons, don't use glue traps. You know, leave them in peace. There are humane ways to deal with any inconvenience. And that's usually all it is. So pest control, entertainment, obviously, one of the good things about the pandemic, and there are quite a lot, is that we are not dissecting in schools because schools are virtual now. Everybody's homeschooling or whatever they're doing. And that means that frogs aren't being taken out of ponds and lakes and streams and cut up in the classroom. There are no little boys dangling frog guts in front of little girls' faces, and there are no children inhaling formaldehyde. But when that's over, one of the things, if you're a child, a teacher, or you know a teacher, or you've got a grandchild, is make sure they know the options, the alternatives, and their right not to cut up a cat's eye or a frog or any other animal. There are sophisticated things they can do. Look for the labels on products and on clothing too, because you might think something is leather and you find out it's grape leather if you read that label. Don't buy anything that's made of wool. And if you think, oh, that sounds extreme, it isn't. We've been in all these shearing sheds and these gentle, beautiful sheep who I talk about in the book. They can recognize people and other sheep from photographs. That's how wonderful they are. Mm. They are beaten from one side of the shed to the other with metal clippers by the people who shear them. It's not just a haircut. So don't buy wool. Find a wool alternative. Alternatives, kind things for everything that's cruel. And inadvertently, you may be supporting something that you don't want to. So get the lists of cruelty-free products. We've got 4,200 companies now that don't test on animals, don't use animal ingredients like placenta or hydrolyzed animal protein. These are slaughterhouse ingredients. You don't want to put that on your face, you know? So all those things are very, very important. And support legislative initiatives. Talk to your representatives and go on the website and see, please, who we need you to contact now. The Iditarod sponsors, the people who are doing awful things to animals in circuses. Please get in touch with us. Look at the website, see where the action alerts are needed, and join the army of the kind.
And while you were speaking, a few people did leave their comments in here. We have one from Susan Hargraves. Ingrid is fantastic. The undercover work and unapologetic direct voices for all the animals not to be harmed since 1982. And yes, Susan is, you know, when I first got into being vegan, she really helped me out, learn more about animal advocacy. So I'm glad she's in here watching as well.
I owe Susan a great debt. Because I was speaking somewhere in Florida and there were stray cats who were in terrible condition behind the hotel. And I was leaving the next morning and the hotel would not help them. And I was able to feed them. I was looking for someone to help. Susan Hargraves, thank you. She came out, she caught them all up, she got them sterilized and she found them homes. Mm. And one of those cats is living with her today.
Oh, wow. And her organization is Animal Hero Kit. So I just want to say a good shout out to Susan. And I'm glad you were able to connect with her. So let's, as we're winding down, I want us, if anybody has any questions or any comments, feel free to leave them in the comments section and we will be posting them on here. So you mentioned schools and students kind of being out and the way of life changing and shifting. One of the things I do want to discuss is what advice do you have for parents who may have a child that, because right now the internet, you can pretty much find anything, finds a video from Peter, finds a video that kind of shows them, you know, a different world that's out there. And now they want to go vegan, but the parent doesn't know what to do. Maybe they might be open, but they just don't know what to do. What would you suggest?
Well, if the parents have any doubt about how healthy it is to go vegan for the child, there should be no doubt. There is the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And I think you have Dr. Neil Barnard speaking tomorrow night. And this PCRM.org has all sorts of advice for parents. At PETA, we have every recipe that you could ever want. And there are other websites like goveg.com that have tons of recipes, some easy, some, you know, exotic, whatever you want. You can have a fake little dinner party for your children if you like. I think the thing to do is to find out what they like to eat and then try to gradually show them they can eat things like that, but be vegan. There are wonderful books online, and I'm sure that Susan Hargrave's organization, Heroes for Animals, that she knows, and on her website too, we'll have a list of kids' books. We give away kids' books on our spay and neuter clinics to the kids of parents who bring their animals in to be fixed, and the kids adore them. There are stories about, you know, a turkey got away from Thanksgiving dinner and ran, and there are wonderful, appreciative things. There are fabulous rescue videos on our website, and videos about a chicken who runs up to greet the child coming home from the school bus every day. Things that just warm your heart, make you see that we are all in a great orchestra of life. Everybody plays a different instrument, maybe, but we're all in this together. We're all brothers and sisters under the skin. So, you know, parents have got, the pandemic will be over before they've had time to do everything they need to do with those children.
And as you mentioned, you have different types of PETA organizations. You have PETA, PETA 2, PETA Kids. So what exactly is PETA 2?
Well, PETA 2 has just been folded into PETA SOS, which is about stopping supremacism or speciesism. But it's really for the teens to 19 or so. And then some college students are involved in it. And it's about activism for the animals. And they do all sorts of things. When the colleges and the schools were open, they would chalk animal rights messages on the sidewalk. They would work with their cafeterias to make sure there were vegan entrees or vegan meals, vegan meal programs. They would table on their campuses. Now they do it virtually. So they have virtual conferences and what have you. But you mentioned our affiliates. We have PETA India. And one of the videos on our website is with all the hotels closed in places like Mumbai and Delhi, you see the monkeys taking back their ancestral homes that were seized in order to build those hotels and jumping in the swimming pools and swimming and swimming and climbing up. You know, you see wonderful things you can show kids and adults, which is elk coming back to the Oregon coast and bathing between the sandbars and the coast. You see goats in England. We've got PETA UK walking down the streets. Deer, I just came up past the cathedral in Washington tonight, walking home, and there was a deer on the lacrosse court, just walking around, having a look. And I think animals are able during this quiet time to reclaim some of what is rightfully theirs. So with rodeos canceled, horse races canceled, dog shows canceled, running of the bulls canceled, there is much to celebrate.
So for wrapping up, we did have a comment in here about the mask. It seems like the masks are super popular. Susan, again, are all the masks sold out? How popular are these items? And can people won't expect this? Go on.
The mask is so popular, it's now been sold out twice. And I think we have just got, I hope I'm right, but I think we have just got some more masks in. And we've got jigsaw puzzles too, with all the animals, the pig, the cow, the chicken, the pangolin, all of them holding signs saying closed live markets. And we now have a costume, which we are launching. No, we are doing a demonstration standing 6 feet apart outside the closed slaughterhouses. And we now have a new costume. We have done the Grim Reaper, and we have done some wonderful man cycled in South Dakota in the snow to stand outside Smithfield when it closed with a sign saying, keep it closed permanently, stop pandemics. You know, they're related to the meat markets, the exotic animal markets for medicine and for clothing. And so, you know, we're just saying you can demonstrate virtually on your own Instagram account or your Facebook or whatever. Do that too.
So in closing, is there anything that we didn't address that you definitely want to make sure you discuss during this conversation?
Thank you for asking that. I mean, there's one thing that's very dear to my heart, and that is please if you're watching, don't just watch, do, because it is going to take all of us. We have to grow this movement. We have to teach others. When we can, we need to feed others. We need to take them shopping. We need to cook for them, or if we can take them out somewhere when this is over to a vegan restaurant, show them what's out there. Look after them. If there's a baby shower, you know, we're going to buy that baby something cruelty-free. If there's a birthday, if it's your birthday and someone says, what do you want? You can do that now. You say, please, I'd like you to go vegan for 2 weeks for me for my birthday. You ask me what I want. That's what I want. We have to grow the movement. We cannot hope. Hope is grand, but action is what it takes. And that means overcoming any hesitation, embarrassment, anything else, and saying the truth, talking about the facts, opening people's eyes, opening their hearts, opening their minds, and just doing until we have made a vegan world or close to it, because that is everything. It's not enough to wish. Wishing doesn't get us anywhere. It's what are you doing as an individual? Because you count. You have the power of the purse, and that is worth everything. And your voice and your typing fingers, use them.